Welcome to the House Resources Committee. Today is January 17th, 2024. We are in the House Resources Committee room in the Alaska State Capitol. With us today is Representative Mears, Representative Armstrong, Representative Dibert, Representative McCabe, Representative Sadler, Representative Wright, and our new member, Representative Thomas Baker from Kotzebue. So we welcome you, Representative Baker, to our committee. And Representative Rauscher is not here yet, and I'm Chairman Tom McKay. So we do have a quorum to do business. We have Representative Kronk in the audience, and I'd like to also thank the staff. We have a lot of staff here today: Zach, Dave, Justin, Linda, and committee aide Ed King, who barely made it back here from Hawaii. Glad to get you back, Ed. Glad you came back instead of deciding to just stay there. I would remind everyone to please silence your cell phones, and welcome everybody back to the second session of the 33rd Legislature. It's great to be back and see you all, and look forward to a very exciting and interesting session here in House Resources. So with that, we are going to start today with two items on today's agenda. The first is House Bill 169, which would make a change to fisheries rehabilitation permits. An amended version of this bill moved through the House Fisheries Committee last year. So I will now bring this committee substitute, the CS, for House Bill 169, Fisheries, before the House Resources Committee. My goal for today is to hear an introduction from the sponsor, then hold the bill until next week. Representative Kronk, please put yourself on the record and introduce this to your bill, and along with your staff, and please introduce your staff for us as well.
Thank you, Chair McKay. Representative Mike Kronk, District 36, and to my right is my staff, Dave Stancliffe.
Let me just say we've been joined by Representative Rauscher. Thank you, Representative Rauscher.
Well, thank you for letting us have this time today. I'm just going to dive right into it for the sponsor statement. This is an act relating to certain fish and establishing a fisheries rehabilitation permit. This legislation would allow individuals, Alaskan corporations, school districts, and other organizations to apply for a fish rehabilitation permit through the Department of Fish and Game. If the commissioner grants a permit, the individuals, Alaskan corporations, school districts, or other organizations would be allowed to collect a limited number of fish, fertilize and hatch the eggs, and then place the unfed natural fish back into the water where they were taken. This will boost the survival rate of fertilized eggs to emergent fry stage from around 5%, which is naturally occurring, to roughly 90%. Similar types of fish rehabilitation permits are already allowed by the department for scientific research or other educational purposes. But these purposes are limited, and thus the data collection, fish rehabilitation projects, and fish population information is limited. This bill allows the private sector and the department to work together in a responsible, collaborative effort to increase the natural salmon populations and scientific data collection throughout the state. This legislation will be one more tool that can be used to ensure that we both today and in the future maximize our resources as stated in our state constitution. Thus, Alaskans will benefit from Alaska's natural fish resources to help feed our families. Former Representative Tallarico tried to introduce this bill, I think about 6 years ago, and it was rejected. And with the shortcoming of fish, whether it's in the Yukon River, the Kuskokwim River, or other rivers in Alaska, 6 years ago, this could have been a game changer at this time. So we were working through the Fisheries Committee. We had some, you know, great additions. I think my staff, Dave, will go through those. But this is a really important bill for our salmon fisheries across Alaska. And there's a lots of entities that are interested in doing this to help, you know, bolster our salmon runs that are failing right now.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dave Stancliffe, staff to Representative Kronk, working on this piece of legislation that has seen some changes in fisheries. I'll go through those in after giving you a quick sectional analysis. Section 1 creates a new section to create fisheries enhancement permit, creates a new subsection for the activities that are allowed under the permit, creates a new subsection that prescribes the application form by the department for people interested in gaining a permit, creates a subsection allowing the Department of Fish and Game Commissioner to issue a permit under certain determinations, creates a subsection regarding factors that the Commissioner of Fish and Game will consider when determining if a permit will be issued. Subsection E creates a new subsection requiring a permit to collect and provide project data, reports requested by the department, and to reasonably communicate with individuals affected by the project. Subsection F creates a subsection that sets the timeline that they must act to get a permit. Subsection G creates a new requirement for the permittee to collect no more than 500,000 eggs, implement controls to avoid the introduction of non-indigenous pathogens, creates a new subsection to ensure that any fish released into state water with enhancement permit under this section will be available for common use, the same way as wild fish are, creates a new subsection I to specify the duration of the permit and how to extend a permit. J creates definitions for the bill, and section 2 amends this section by adding a new subsection. It states that the fishery enhancement projects under this law shall be considered by the commissioners outlined in 1605-871-D because precautions in subsection D will not damage fish enhancement project. Section 3 amends this section to allow enhancement projects created through this act to be included in regional comprehensive salmon plans. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I will go over the changes that were made in fisheries, some of those changes suggested by the commercial fishing industry and people that represent it. Some of the changes were put forth by the department. On page 3, line 1, it adds the words local and wild to the species of salmon. Page 4, line 5, deleted these words, and I think this was a game changer. If the commissioner fails to act within that period, the applicant is approved and the department shall issue a permit. Page 4, line 18, adds the word, again, insurance. The commissioner may modify, suspend, or revoke a permit issued under this section for cause. If a permittee violates this section, the commissioner may, after providing the permitting notice and an opportunity to be heard, suspend or revoke a permit issued under this section. And then the word tribe was added on page 4, line 24, as some of the entities that might be considered for issuing this permit, as well as schools and other local governments. That encapsulates what has taken place up till now, and the record coming out of fisheries was 5 do pass and 1 no rec.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for the sponsor, Representative Kronk, or his staff? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Kronk. Help, I think I understand the permit system for individual, you know, for subsistence and personal use, but I don't know much about the existing permitting system for the divisions for its existing propagative permits. Can you help us understand what those are and how this would relate to this new fisheries rehabilitation permit would relate to the other system?
Mr. Chair, on behalf of Representative Kronk, this is a new program as far as opening it up wider to the programs that already exist for educational purposes. I don't see it conflicting in any way, Representative Sadler, with existing programs. The idea here is in areas that that the department doesn't get to and have a lot of ability to increase salmon reproduction by 85% into our streams. It makes sense that some of the tribes and some of the local people out in the rural areas could actually become a permittee, report to the department, and significantly raise our salmon population by simply putting so many more smolt into the streams that it's going to be a tremendous difference.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Wright, do you have a question? Okay. Representative Rauscher had a question.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm just wondering, I was looking at this last section here on page 5, and basically it talks about the plan that the commissioner can alter according to region, according to each probably individual situation, whatever that is. When it talks about a plan, though, is this something very expensive, very elaborate, or is this something, I mean, the average plan? I mean, what are we talking about here to make this happen? Is it a big dollar item, or is this something that somebody can get into low cost, or what are we trying to do here?
Mr. Chairman, as I understand from the department, they would develop a plan according to the populations and the need in given areas, and the plan will be very fluid so that they can maximize their returns. It certainly would be no more complicated than the plans they already use for scientific and some study. One of the wonderful features of this, if the school district gets involved, our young people start to understand where salmon come from and how they survive, how to make more of them.
Okay. Well, it's basically my question. You repeated it back to me. I don't quite understand what is involved in any of the plans then.
Well, I understood you to want to know if this is going to be a more complicated plan than what they had.
Through the chair, if I could. I don't understand any of the plans because I've never seen one. I was hoping you'd just tell us something about what a plan looks like. How's that sound?
The Department of Fish and Game will give you details that I will not be able
to. Okay, thank you very much.
I'm advised we do have someone from the Department of Fish and Game here available to answer questions. Okay. Representative Sadler, we'll hold Representative Rauscher's question for the...
My question was also going to be directed to Fish and Games. That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay, so if I could invite the Fish and Game staff to come to the table. Please introduce yourselves. Oh, and Representative McCabe also has a question.
Not for them, though.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I know. Keeping track of people. So please put yourself on the record, gentlemen.
For the record, my name is Flip Pryor. I'm the aquaculture section chief for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, Division of Commercial Fisheries.
My name is Joe Felkel. I'm the legislative liaison for the department.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. So Representative Rauscher, would you like to ask your question to these two fine fellows?
Yeah, I appreciate it. Through the chair again. I know nothing about what a plan looks like. I know nothing about what it would take to accomplish something in a small stream or something in a large stream, some with thousands of fish in it or something with 50 fish in it, depending on what you're trying to repopulate, or no fish at all. So I was just wondering, can you tell us what a plan would actually consist of to make something like this happen, so I get an idea of what we're talking about, so we can get an idea of what this whole bill is about? Thank you.
All right. Answering the question through the chair, I believe if you turn to the last page of the bill, you'll see 1610-375, which is the current regional plans that are used for the PNP hatchery program. This would just add to the that plan, which is something the regional planning team of each area sits down, then they go through. It basically puts local knowledge on the paper. So you wouldn't be adding any burden onto an applicant. It would be the applicant would bring a program forward, and it would be reviewed in, does this fit within the plan that currently exists? Does that make sense?
I'm going to relent. Thank you.
Okay. All right. You want to try to take a stab at that, legislative liaison?
Chair, if I may further clarify, this section, we see it as a conforming amendment to our regional salmon plans that makes it so we must consider salmon rehabilitation projects in the area as part of those plans we already have. But I think Flip can speak better to what those plans entail.
Okay. You rest your case, Representative Rauscher. Okay. Well, okay. How about Representative Mears?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, one of the things that was mentioned in the sponsor statement was that if it changes from fishery, that if a permit isn't issued by a certain amount of time, then basically it de facto comes into effect. There's some limits on individual permits for 50,000 eggs being harvested, but what would happen if a number of permits came in from a region, Fish and Game wasn't able to keep up? Is there like an adoption in the regional plan saying that there's a limit to how many fish might be taken, or is it just hope we don't get too many.
Okay. addressing the question through the chair, each application would be reviewed on its own merit, but it would be taken into consideration if there's multiple permits for that same area, same spot. We would look at number of fish that return to that area and what is the available broodstock and limit it that way. There is no cap in the regional salmon plans per se, like for, you know, per each stream or whatever, but that would be taken into consideration during the review.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. So my children went through the Anchorage School District system where there was the Fish and School project. And so I've seen many salmon tanks out in the hallways. And, yeah, that's a fun project. It's certainly different than this, but that opportunity to watch fish come from eggs was a fun thing that my kids had to do. So now people get to do it for science and livelihood.
If I may elaborate on that, what this would do would be an extension of that aquatic resource permit. It would be done very similar with the same reviews and the same process for evaluation. And yeah, that is our most popular permit we issue.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this plan, or this bill, as I understand it, is quite different from a regular hatchery. I've had some discussion with the genesis of this bill, which was a guy with a 5-gallon bucket up by his house that basically did it himself and buried the eggs, the fertilized eggs, in a gravel bar. And because of the care he was able to take, actually got huge returns compared to what even nature does, right? So I think what I'm hearing here is it's still going to be incorporated in any kind of plan that you have with the major hatcheries. In other words, the Katoy hatchery or Kodiak hatchery or Cordova, whatever the hatchery is, if there's somebody in that area that wants to do the bucket plan, if you will, or a tribe or a native village or something, and they want to do this, or even a school wants to do this in a river with a bucket, you will have to incorporate that or consider that when you're thinking about your hatchery fish as well, because we don't want to release too many fish into the habitat, right?
Through the chair, that is correct. So each regional salmon plan addresses the specific area set forth by the commissioner for salmon enhancement, and that would all fall under the same umbrella. So it would, we wouldn't stack a bunch of these on top of major production in a little system. I guess that's what you're
follow up.
Thank you. So part of this, the difference, I guess, between the bucket plan or this kind of small little plan or procedure and a hatchery, and I used to fly for the hatcheries in Kodiak, so I'm a little familiar, but down there we would take eggs from like Fraser Lake and bring them back to Kodiak, and then we might release them when they finally became smolt in Lake Onnefognak somewhere. This plan would take the eggs from the river and fertilize them in the same river, so the genetic stock would be the same, right? So it's actually sort of better than hatchery fish, if I may. You know, it's a little bit of a license, I guess, but you might correct me if I'm wrong on that. I'm kind of looking for the information to
addressing your question through the chair. No, you're right on top of it. Another level of oversight here is what they call fish transport permit. So the department would regulate where those fish could go. But in this case, the idea is just what you said, go into a specific river, take the eggs out, incubate them, put them right back in that same spot. And I think really the only difference of what we've got going on here is who can apply to do this. Currently, it's limited to PMP hatchery programs. And then the aquatic resource permits are educational and corporate, agreement with the state, working with the state. This would just open it up.
One more.
And follow up, Rep. McCabe.
Thanks. So I think what a lot of the opposition to hatcheries is coming because of the Russian oligarch hatcheries that are releasing billions of fish into the habitat that Alaska salmon need in the ocean to survive, and they're taking up the food and the habitat. This would seem to me, this particular, the bucket plan, as Representative Kronk and I called it for a while when we were discussing it, would seem to be a little bit closer to nature. We're limited to 500,000 per per person, and I think the commissioner would further limit that to the number of people that could do it. But it would seem to be a smarter, better way of doing it than taking fish from everywhere and just releasing billions of them into the ecosystem. Is that right?
Through the chair. Yeah, yes, that is right.
Thanks.
Well, you've been right about everything, Representative McCabe.
I asked the real question, my questions.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Pryor, you're probably a good person to ask this question. Some of us have better knowledge about the hatchery, the propagative permits. Could you give the rest of us kind of a primer on the different kinds of permits? You mentioned fish transport permits. Again, my universe is I know the individual permits, but what are the kinds of permits that ConFish issues for fisheries, hatchery, rehabilitation, and how would this slot in with those? Not if they'd conflict, or just help us understand how many, what types there are, areas of concentration, just make sure we understand the universe in which this would operate.
Okay. Addressing the question to the chair. So currently, there's what they call an aquatic resource permit, and that is limited to educational facilities and under a cooperative agreement with the state. The other, when you go into propagation, would be the hatchery PMP permit. And
what's that?
The private nonprofit.
Thank you.
hatchery permit. And really what this bill would do is specifically address the rehabilitation type projects, which we don't currently do. That was the old FRED division, Fisheries Rehabilitation Enhancement and Development, was into that. But since that went away, the department really doesn't focus too much on that. There are a few examples, but very few. And it just opens up another avenue that specifically addresses the rehabilitation.
Very good.
Follow-up?
Actually, Representative McCabe's question kind of went to this, but why would the permits that we're proposing creating now increase fry survival by such a massive from 5% to 95%? I assume it's a range, but that's a dramatic increase. What would account for that?
Okay, interesting question to the chair. It's all the incubation. You're protecting the eggs. You fertilize them, and then you're protecting them using, I'm going to guess there's going to be a lot of stream-side incubators, which basically you're putting them in a box. Predators can't get to them. They controls the temperature, the less likely to freeze. It just it reduces a lot of variables, and you get that level of survival.
Okay, and I guess I will just say I appreciate the sponsor's goals and innovation. We've heard an awful lot at the interim about the dire state of some salmon fisheries, and so the idea of letting 1,000 flowers blossom and people do more to rehabilitate and return more fish to the ocean to come back as big fat salmon is a good thing. So I'm hoping to make progress. Thanks.
Okay, Representative Mears.
Thank you. I have a fiscal question and a science question. Through the chair, my fiscal question is, I see on the fiscal note there's just over $48,000 a year. I'm assuming that's for a part-time person to process the permits and expansion of the existing program.
I can take that one. Yes, that is correct. The amount listed there is for one part-time fisheries biologist to position in Juneau.
Excellent. I like Representative McCabe being right about some things. And then the science question is, it looks like, I'm sorry, through the chair, this is one way to potentially increase some viability of eggs and return of fish to the stream. Are there other, and maybe it's a larger discussion than outside the bill, are there other things that we should be considering to help on a small scale, having greater fish returns within our salmon streams.
Through the chair. Well, it's kind of a loaded question. really, what this is addressing is egg to fry survival. In Alaska, most of the places where the salmon are struggling, it's not a habitat issue like it is down south. It's not because a dam got put up or something blocking the fish from returning and spawning. And so really you're just increasing the number of fry going back into the water, increasing the spawning success. And if there's other things, it's habitat related, and this isn't addressing that.
Ben, I want to apologize. I'm tardy in recognizing Representative Sumner has joined us in the audience. Are there any other questions for Department of Fish and Game or the sponsor? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, following on Representative Meir's comment on the 48,000, I see that's coming out of the unrestricted general fund. Is there any looking into whether that could be a repurposed position of something that's already existing, considering shortening of staff in recent years?
For the record, Joe Felkel, through the chair. So the statewide aquaculture and planning permitting section has been reduced in the past years. And so because of some other added duties over the years as well, we have looked at that. And this part-time position is what we would need to do the additional work, if that answers your question.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Dybert.
Thank you.
Get everybody in here today.
Through the chair. I'm just curious if this is happening elsewhere that you are, learning from in other places around the nation.
Through the chair, I'm not familiar with the nation, I guess, but this is very similar to the aquatic resource permits we have, and we have issued some to some thinking of an example was Auk Bay Lab did a little project where they reared some fish and let them go in the lake, and what they were looking for was a hatchery effect. That was an experiment. They just released fish for 3 years, but there's fish coming back. So they produced fish by doing a program very similar to what we're talking about now.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a question for Representative Kronk. If you could come back up, Representative Kronk, please. And thank you, Fish and Game gentlemen. Thank you very much. So we welcome Representative Kronk back to the table, and Representative McCabe has a question.
Thanks. So Representative Kronk, in fisheries, when we heard this, you had a very good way of explaining the difference between what this would mean for Upper Yukon fish and the amount of miles that they have to travel. And maybe that would be helpful for some people to understand why we're so interested in this type of and it's a PNP, so it's not a profit thing. It's rehabilitating the fish, as I understand it, especially for the native communities that depend on fish for not only their livelihood, but their culture and pretty much their entire day-to-day existence. So if you wouldn't mind expounding on that a little bit, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you. Through the chair, Rep. McCabe. Obviously, the Yukon River is a really long river, right? And I guess I fall back on my, fifth or sixth grade science class that the longer that river is, the more obstacles there are for any salmon that have to return to that the ocean. And right now we're seeing like the lowest returns of Chinook salmon on the Yukon River. And it's not like it's not a statewide problem, but specifically on the Yukon, we haven't subsistence fished for, I believe, 3 years now. And there was a little bit of subsistence fishing for chum this summer, but, an example of what this would be. So let's just pick a river in the interior, Salter River. It's one of the highest producing Chinook rivers on the Yukon. And so if 5,000 eggs are laid, 250 of those actually hatch. And in this program, if we were doing some of the wet boxes per se, 4,700 eggs would hatch. So we're substantially increasing the number of fry back into the river to get those returns built back up. And the other thing that I think we've seen over the course of time here, especially over the last 15 years, is I've seen pictures up in Eagle, which is, let's just say, 1,400 miles from the ocean, of 40, 60, 70-pound female king salmon. There's a substantial amount of eggs. Now those same females are returning at 18 pounds or 14 pounds. So we're having a drastic reduction of number of eggs that are actually laid because of the size of the fish that are returning. So a program like this, and I envision, especially along the Yukon, specific villages where they have spawning streams to use their kids to teach them how to do this, but to substantially, you know, get more fry back in that river to return so we can have these fish. But you guys all know the importance of this is culture. This is food. This is life. I think the most important fish is the one on the table. And that's what this aims to do. I guess in a big global view, of the biggest kind of example of this would be the Gulkana hatchery. This is exactly what the Gulkana hatchery is. And people fought against it, but the Gulkana hatchery has produced millions and millions of fish for the Gulkana River and the Copper River. And that's a very heightened level of what this could do. But we're looking at a lot more smaller hands-on wet boxes, et cetera, to get the number of fry back into the river. So I hope that answered your question.
Thank you.
Okay, looking to the committee for any other questions. Any other closing comments, Representative Kronk?
Through the chair, I appreciate your time. This is a, I don't want to say dire. I don't like using the word crisis, you know, because that just brings emotions into it. But this is a, you know, we're at a crossroads now. We absolutely need to do something. And anything we can do to benefit that doesn't harm, these aren't frankenfish. These are, you know, like Representative McCabe said, these are the eggs and the sperm that those salmon have. They're going right back into the river. So they're not changing genetically. And, you know, so these are the same fish. We're just hoping to produce a lot more fry to rebuild our runs so we can bring our culture back. You know, people can get food back in their, you know, on their table. So appreciate your time. Look forward to the next meeting.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Kronk. And thank you, Mr. Stancliffe and the gentleman from Fish and Game. So I will set an amendment deadline for 12 o'clock Monday, January 22nd. And we'll hold HB 169 in committee until then.
Thank you.
So thank you very much. We'll take a brief at ease in preparation for the next bill. Okay, I'll bring the House Resources Committee back to order. Our second item on the agenda today is House Bill 177. This bill would direct the Office of the Governor to develop a critical minerals plan. This is the first hearing on HB 177 in the 33rd Legislature. My goal for today is to hear an introduction from the sponsor, listen to an invited testimony, then hold the bill until next week. HB 177 is now before the House Resources Committee, and we welcome Representative Sadler to the table. Representative, please put yourself on the record and introduce us to your bill.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's a pleasure to be with my fellow members of the House Resources Committee. For the record, this is Representative Dan Sadler, House District 24, Chugankik River, Richwood, and Thunderbird Falls. It's a pleasure to bring before you House Bill 177, the Critical and Essential Minerals Bill. I introduce this bill, Mr. Chairman, because I want the state of Alaska to be able to take its rightful leadership role in providing critical and essential minerals to our country. And before we go any further, it's probably important to define some terms. Essential minerals are the minerals we need, our nation needs, for industry, for consumers, for national defense. You know, if it can't be grown, it's got to be mined. And critical minerals are those essential minerals that we don't have enough of or don't have reliable, secure sources of. Now, critical and essential minerals include some minerals and elements that we're familiar with, like copper, tin, gold, zinc, uranium, graphite, nickel, silver, all things we know and love, right? But they also include minerals you may never have heard of, like yttrium, niobium, dysprosium, and praseodymium, God help me, which I had never heard of before, but they are essential to our way of life. They're fundamental components of many of today's ubiquitous technologies, like our phones, our computers, our household appliances. And to keep our economy and our modern lives moving forward, we have to ensure we have a plan to access these critical minerals. Now, we've seen the demand for these minerals increase in recent years, and we're likely to see them continue to increase, maybe even exponentially, as the demand for these renewable energy sources, for example, grows. Critical and essential minerals are a key element to many emerging technologies like electric vehicles, solar panels, windmills, etc. What's more, these minerals are increasingly essential components of the high-technology industrial processes and, frankly, weapon systems that more and more play important roles in maintaining a robust, strong national defense. These days, our friends across the Pacific, China, is home to most of the global market for processing and refining critical minerals, which has concerning implications for the health of our nation's economy and the strength of our nation's armed services and defense capabilities. It's vitally important that our nation be able to reliably produce such minerals and to develop them and use them to manufacture technology-forward programs, products and systems. This bill, HB 177, helps us meet that imperative. It directs our state government to assess the state's potential as an alternative source of these minerals, to identify strategies to attract industrial development, and to review the possible impacts of potential regulatory regimes on the development of these industries. This proposal has the potential to not only decrease our reliance on imported essential and critical minerals, but also to increase investment in our state's natural resource industry. Now, we have the opportunity in Alaska to position ourselves as a competitive source of these minerals in the global supply chain as well. This bill requires that the Department of Natural Resources, DNR, and the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, DCCED, to provide the information that the industry needs and state officials need to begin taking the next steps towards making Alaska a globally competitive source of critical and essential minerals. Mr. Chairman, we have several individuals prepared to testify and give us some background on this. We have Brent Sheets, who's the director of the University of Alaska's Fairbanks Petroleum Development Lab at the Institute of North Engineering. From the Alaska Metal Mines, we have Karen Mathias, the executive director, to speak from the industry standpoint. And we have the executive director of the Alaska Miners Association, Deantha Skabinski. They'll explain what the bill means, how it could be implemented, and what the benefits might be to the state and nation. For your questions, we also have people from DNR's Division of Geologic and Geophysical Surveys, and from DCCED's Division of Community and Regional Affairs. So we have a full panoply of experts for you. I appreciate your time and attention. Look forward to the presentation, first to the sectional analysis and the presentation from our experts. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Sadler. And now staff will do the sectional.
Thank you, Chair McKay, members of the committee. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Katie McCall, staff to Representative Sadler. I'll go through the sectional analysis for you here. So this is House Bill 177, version A. Section 1, subsection A, adds a new section of uncodified law directing the Office of the Governor to develop a plan for the state to develop a plan for the state to encourage exploration, production, and refining of the minerals needed to support emerging renewable energy technologies. The plan must specifically identify strategies to attract industry investment and position the state's critical mineral production at the center of U.S. production and manufacturing initiatives employing critical minerals. The plan must also review the impacts of various regulatory frameworks on mineral development. So the plan has two components. One is a report from DNR and the other is a report from DCCED. And those are outlined in the following subsections. So subsection B directs the Department of Natural Resources to provide a report to the legislature by the start of the legislative session in January of 2026 that compares the state's current mineral production and potential future production to national and global production of critical and essential minerals. The report must identify strategies to increase industry exploration and state production of critical and essential minerals in the next 3, 5, and 10 years. The report must also compare the state's permitting timelines and exploration incentives to those in other jurisdictions. The department may consult with other state and federal agencies, the University of Alaska, industry representatives, and advocacy organizations to compile the required information for the report. Subsection C directs the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to provide a report to the legislature by the start of the legislative session in January 2026 that identifies the state's role in the global energy transition. The report must include the potential role of Alaska's mineral resources in the supply chain for electric batteries, solar panels, wind turbines, and consumer devices. The department may consult with the appropriate state and federal agencies to compile the required information for the report. And the report must include the value of the state's location in the global supply chain and identify strategies for in-state innovation, manufacturing, and transportation for the next 3, 5, and 10 years. And Mr. Chairman, that concludes the sectional analysis.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions so far from the committee for the sponsor and the staff? Representative Armstrong.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, I think as my colleagues know, this is a topic I'm very passionate and excited about. I had a couple of questions, but you can circle back to me. My first one was, sorry if there's feedback, under the things that the reports are to explore, as excited as I am about mineral development in our state, I'm equally as mindful about the roles and the impact that it has on communities. And I'm curious, thinking about the strategies to attract industry, I think one of the things that does that is strong community favorability and involvement. Is there a reason we didn't explicitly state pathways for working with communities for this to kind of unfold with, I guess the easy way to say it, as little drama as possible? Or were we just trying to keep this as tight as possible in terms of business and industry strategies?
Not sure, I forget if that goes. Representative Armstrong through the chair. I believe we're trying to piggyback off the existing system of mineral exploration and data development and development of the industry. I see no reason why we would not, the departments would not consult with communities and consider the impact. I guess I didn't think it was necessary to explicitly call that out, but I would presume that they would implement their existing good standards as they conduct those operations.
Thank you. And one more separate question.
And follow up.
Thank you, through the chair. And then I was just curious, it says for DCE or Department of Commerce, mm-hmm. It says supply chain for electric batteries, solar panels, wind turbines, and consumer devices. Curious if I could just see us adding or other relevant technologies that may come up so that we're not constrained in what they can explore. I know that's kind of a small pedantic thing, but I just think about how fast technology is moving and other applicable uses of minerals, and if you would be open to considering expanding what they can look at, or if you had a reason why you wanted to constrain it to these products.
Through the chair, Representative Armstrong, I think that's a good idea. Certainly technology and science develops at a rapid rate, so I would be open to having an amendment to broaden that to whatever else the world in the future bring to us.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Okay. Now we will go to our invited testimony. So first up, via Teams, Mr. Brent Sheets. Mr. Sheets, can you hear me okay?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Okay. So Mr. Sheets is director of the Petroleum Development Lab at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Director Sheets, welcome to House Resources. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. We will advance your slides from here.
Thank you. Indeed, my name is Brent Sheets. I'm the director of the Petroleum Development Laboratory at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. It seems odd that the Petroleum Development Laboratory would be in this minerals space, but we deal with a lot of resource development issues in addition to just trying to crack the heavy oil resource on the North Slope. We're also heavily involved in the carbon capture and sequestration efforts within the state. We're also seeking to demonstrate some small-scale coal plant technology. Finally, I'm the principal investigator for a DOE-funded carbon ore, rare earth, and critical minerals project, affectionately known as CORE-CM. And I'm also, at liberty to say that the Petroleum Development Laboratory, the Petroleum Engineering Program, excuse me, at the university is transitioning to the Energy Resources Engineering Program. And we're no longer looking at just petroleum, but we're looking at, traditional resource development as well as getting into the renewable energy space. And some curriculum is being developed with ASAP and within the university. I think that program begins this fall. So we'll have to come up with a new name for our lab. We'll move on to the next slide, please. I should point out that DGGS is indeed our partner in this DOE-funded endeavor, and these next two slides are directly from their work. We're really happy to have them as partners. As you know, Alaska has long been a major source of some of the world's most valuable resources. Alaskan geologists have been very active in characterizing the state's mineral resources and have been thorough and very comprehensive in their efforts within the capabilities of the characterization technology and the budgets available to them at those times. The Alaska team, particularly the DGGS, is examining this large body of legacy work and is conducting some preliminary examinations of some of the archived minerals that are retained in the Alaska Geological Material Center down in Anchorage. The work's already yielding results and has confirmed indeed that Alaska has abundant untapped rare earth element resources. Rare earth elements can be found in most of the known mine sites, as illustrated in this map, and there's obviously more discoveries to come. The potential rare earth elements are in red. The Ray River in your upper right is an example of a surprising find brought to light by this DOE-funded CoreCM program. DGGS reviewed some old reports, leading them to collect samples just several miles up the Ray River near the Yukon River Bridge. And we believe those samples will demonstrate that they hold world-class germanium and gallium deposits, which are going to be ripe for someone to lease. And that's important because China has embargoed those elements from us. In addition, preliminary studies with the use of Ely Coal Mine, for example, who's also partners of ours in the CoreCM program, demonstrate that there are some seams, some ash areas within their leases that may have economic concentration of rare earth elements, which illustrates the importance of also looking in these coal mine areas. And we're just at the very preliminary discussions of talking to them about how we can help them monetize those resources. If you'll go on to the next slide, please. Though vastly underdeveloped and underexplored, Alaska has historically been and continues to be a producer of rare earth elements and critical minerals. The historic rare earth element production includes most of the things that you see on this slide: antimony, barite, chromium, and a whole bunch of ones that I can't pronounce either. Current production includes zinc, germanium. The Red Dog mine in Northwest Alaska is the largest producer of zinc in the world. The germanium is contained in the same ore with that zinc, and that ore is separated during the smelting process at the company-owned smelter in Canada. So a lot of ores from around the world are combined there. So we don't really know exactly the germanium production that comes out of the Red Dog mine. And unfortunately, we don't get to take credit for it in Alaska. But many critical minerals are needed for economic and national security or supplied by countries that have adversarial relationships with the United States. So Alaska is strategically important because most of the 34 critical minerals shown on this chart are strategic minerals. Alaska has the potential to supply most of those commodities. And with the addition of zinc to the critical minerals list, Alaska is now the nation's largest producer of critical minerals, thanks to the Red Dog mine. We'll go on to the next slide, please. Kind of echoing some of the comments that have already been made, the current bill seems to emphasize rare earth elements in the context of the renewable energy industry. I would echo the sentiment that's already been expressed and would recommend adopting an even broader perspective. Rare earth elements, metals, alloys are in computers, cell phones, catalytic converters on vehicles, fluorescent lights, LED lights. They also play an essential role in national defense, night vision goggles, precision guided weapons, satellites. So they're used everywhere. So the next slide, please. That actually brings us to really what the Carbon Ore Rare Earth Critical Minerals Program is about, CoreCM. Simply put, our mission is to help establish a critical minerals industry in the state. This is consistent with DOE's vision. DOE has said that they want to invest in regions to accelerate research that will enable commercial deployment of advanced processing and production of rare earth elements and critical minerals and high-value non-fuel uses of coal. They want to support engagement of public-private partnerships. They want to advance new and innovative technology development, as well as the potential for new product production. They want to advance opportunities for the education and training of the next generation of technicians, skilled workers, and STEM professionals. The next slide, please. In pursuit of that, the Department of Energy has established 13 of these core CM centers around the country because they're trying to get the country into a competitive space with China. All 13 of these core CM projects are currently in phase one. You see three phases on this chart. All the centers have the same funding. We all have the same tasks. We all have the same objectives. There will be a down select from 13 centers to 8 centers for phase two. Then again, from 8 centers to 5 centers for phase three. And you can see a significant increase in funding for each of them. Phase one is a planning period. We are to make our case to the Department of Energy as to why our core CM should be one of those that continue. Frankly, the cost share requirements for phase two and phase three are going to be a challenge for us, but we're very fortunate and so happy to have DGGS as fantastic partners in our core CM program. Aside from doing really great work, because they are official partners with us, whatever they spend in furthering rare earth elements and critical mineral opportunities in the state, then I'm able to count their expenditures as in-kind match. So the continuing partnership with DGGS would be important for our state as we kind of pursue these phase two funding opportunities. And if we can bring in DEC, even better. Therefore, I'm really encouraged by the committee's attention to better understand what the opportunities for rare earth elements are here and just continue to do what you're doing. And we all benefit from it as a state and more selfishly for the core CM program. If you go to the next slide, this one I need to spend a little bit more time on because it goes into each of the tasks that we are implementing to fulfill the Department of Energy's objectives. Task number two, which is the DOE objective number one there, where are the rare earth elements found? So DGGS is responsible for meeting this first objective of ours. And in April of 2023, DGGS published the Alaska Basinal Assessment of Carbon Ores and Rare Earth Elements. It was prepared as a deliverable under our contract with the Department of Energy, and it just broadly summarizes our efforts so far. It's not as detailed as many DGGS mineral assessments are, nor was it intended to be. Instead, it just reviews data sources that are available to us. It describes new data that has been derived from the GMC. It describes the geological plate types where we might expect to find more rare earth elements. HB177 would enable the DGGS to further its efforts on the core CM program, providing you with the information you seek while also fulfilling a deliverable to DOE. DOE objective number two, our task three is waste stream reuse. This is often overlooked. This includes looking at tailing piles, legacy tailing piles from around the country. It involves working with our existing mines to see what is going into their tailing piles, maybe with the idea of modifying their existing processing so that we can capture some of those rare earth elements before they end up in the tailings. We even have one of our researchers using artificial intelligence to go through the DEC database to see what is in there for hazardous waste, because what's hazardous under the DEC hat might be valuable to us on the rare earth elements piece of it. So that's one of our main objectives, is to take care of that waste stream. What can we harvest before it goes in there? This causes me to pause and take a step back too. I should point out, rare earth elements aren't really all that rare. They're everywhere around us. It's just that they're in really small concentrations that make them very difficult to get at economically. A friend of mine uses an illustration that I really like. Imagine that you have a steak on your plate, and your task is to separate the salt, the little the little salt crystals that you've put on your steak as flavoring. That's what harvesting rare earth elements is like. And that's what makes them rare. It's not that they're not that they're not out there. They're out there. They're just out there in such small concentrations that the challenge is to get at them economically. So I'll be back to the tasks here. Our task four, DOE objective number three, strategies for infrastructure, industries, and businesses. So we tend to look at rare earth elements. We tend to think that the first place that we're going to be able to harvest them is from existing mines. Those existing mines have already invested in the infrastructure. If you have a new mine, then that find is going to have to be large enough to economically allow you to build out all the infrastructure that goes at it. So one of the things that we're looking at is in Alaska, what are the infrastructure needs for brand new mines? How do existing mines need to change their infrastructure to enable rare earth elements? What's the logistical chain getting into Alaska? What are roads, bridges? You know, if you have a really good rare earth element find, but it's in the middle of nowhere, it does you no good. But if you have a mediocre rare earth elements find and it's 5 miles off the highway, well, you can get at that. And so the economics all change. So the Department of Energy recognizes that. Our tasks also look at that. Objective number four, our task five, concerns technology assessment, development, and field testing. This task has us assessing technology gaps across the full REE and critical mineral value chain for Alaska, including innovative and sustainable mining techniques for the minerals, processes to separate and purify rare earth elements and critical minerals, and technologies that incorporate coal-derived carbon, rare earth elements, and critical minerals into value-added intermediate and end-use products, such as the renewable energy industry suggested in HB 177. As part of this task, we're also looking into non-fuel uses of coal. In the interest of time, I won't go into the detail on those projects other than to point out that DOE is keen to promote alternative uses of coal, and that's part of this package. DOE objective number five, our task six, is entitled the Technology Innovation Centers. During phase one, each core CM center is required to formulate plans for their regional technology innovation center that is designed to specifically look at the challenges in their region that's keeping their region's rare earth elements from reaching market. The Technology Innovation Centers are intended to be platforms where we develop and validate core CM technologies at a laboratory scale, including technologies that utilize advanced manufacturing techniques. DOE will subsidize these technology innovation centers initially, but the goal is for all these technology innovation centers to become supported by the industry and their basins that they're serving. So DOE will subsidize them for, you know, 7 to 10 years, but after that, it's sink or swim, and I'm in full support of that. That's how we measure our value. And finally, DOE objective number six, our task seven, is stakeholder outreach and education. In fact, that was 20% of our score was public outreach. Plans will include, you know, tech transfer, education, training programs, science, technology, engineering professionals. Stakeholder outreach efforts will include collaborations too with other R&D projects funded by DOE and with other core CM centers. So that's this task, this page. I'm sorry to spend so much time on it. That brings us to the REE value chain, the next chart. This graph illustrates all that's involved in the REE value chain, whether it be from the renewable energy industry or any other industry. These steps are the same. In Alaska, it makes sense that our default is going to be to focus on exploration and mining as the part of that value chain. But mining alone isn't much use to a manufacturer of batteries, for example, right? So long before that REE can be incorporated into a product, it has to undergo all these steps in series that are illustrated here. The more of these steps that we can perform in state, then obviously the higher the value to those of us that live in this state. So starting at the bottom, you know, after the ore is mined, you'll likely want to concentrate that ore on the mine site so that you're shipping off less material that is of no market value. then that concentrated ore ends up at a facility where the rare earth elements are separated to form oxides. That's mostly commonly done through acid leaching. So you have a waste stream product you have to deal with there. But yielding these rare earth oxides, that's REOs on this chart, then that REO is sent to a metal refinery. And then finally, it's incorporated into a product. As we all know, Alaska exports its ore for processing outside the state. So even if we start, you know, mining critical minerals, they still need to be separated into rare earth elements and processed into a form that allows for manufacturing. We're at a significant disadvantage to the lower 48 because of our high energy costs, frankly, and because of our logistical challenges. We're kind of at the end of the supply chain. If we can overcome then there's no reason that we can't become a mining and processing mecca for our country. I use Utah as my example. They have a healthy mining industry and a healthy tourism industry. The two live in harmony. They have cheap power. I'm talking to some mines here that are sending their product to lower 48 for processing. I ask them why, and it comes down to the cost of energy. They can get 8-cent power down there. We can't even touch that. We're working to crack that nut, but that's a topic for a different hearing on another day. If we could go to the next slide, additional assets, please. Up to this point, I focused on our Corsium program and our partnership with DGGS. But thanks to appropriations that the legislative body made to the university last year, there's other parts of the university that have also investing in resources to enable a rare earth elements industry in Alaska. For example, the Institute of Northern Engineering is remodeling a lab and putting an ICP-MS. That's a device that lets us take a piece of ore and figure out what the elements are in it. There are ICP-MS machines in Alaska, but none of them are being used on mineral assessment, at least not that I know of. And increasingly, if you send samples out to the lower 48 for ICP-MS, if there's coal involved at all, they won't even touch it. So it's a good in-state capability that UAF is investing in. The Geophysical Institute operates a hyperspectral imaging facility in the state that allows them to fly over large swaths of land and be able to discern what minerals are on the surface. The Geophysical Institute also has an advanced instrumentation lab full of instruments that we plan to use in the Core CM Center, because before you can decide how to separate an element from an ore, you have to characterize it. The GI allows us to do that. UAA is investing in bioreactors to separate elements from ores without the use of acids. They're using little critters, if you will. And University of Alaska Southeast and UAF are both expanding their respective efforts to provide mine training and outreach to the communities. And the last slide is simply thank you and my contact information.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sheets. I must say this is a very exciting field, and I think I don't need to point out to our committee here, this is one reason why it's so exciting to be involved in resources in Alaska, and then Representative Rauscher with Energy Committee and Representative McCabe with Transportation Committee. It all ties together, and if we are to someday realize our dream of a really diversified economy, Mr. Sheets hit on it directly with low-cost energy and transportation, with the ability to access these areas, we could have a very, very exciting future, like some of our folks who visited Iceland earlier this fall. I believe it was 2 cents per megawatt hour, very low cost of energy, and enabled them to build, I believe it was 3 smelters, and really diversify their economy and make a lot of money. So are there any questions for Mr. Sheets at this point? Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sheets, for presenting to us today. I'm, of course, learning more about this DOE program, and I wanted to know if there are requirements for continuing through these phases that you see that you might need support from us to continue to be engaged in that process.
Well, the main one would be just being able to meet our match. But again, the DOE is very generous as long as we can partner with DGGS and their expenditures that benefit the state with critical minerals, that also benefits us. I'm excited to hear from this bill that you are asking Commerce to get into some of the products piece of it. That actually would be very helpful to us as well. I'd like to pursue engaging them. So I would say as long as the state continues to pursue this, remember us and we'll put that in our partnership and we can crack this nut together. I would say we have a 20% cost match. So whatever the state invests in this, for every dollar, DOE is putting $4 in it. And it seems like the state's objectives here and the Department of Energy's objectives of getting the nation into this field are directly aligned. And it's just fine if you continue to fund the state agencies as you are, and we just all come under one umbrella, and I think we can march in that direction together, get a little momentum going. So I don't have any specific requests.
Follow up
for our bill sponsor, Mr. Sadler, through the chair. I didn't notice a fiscal note here on this bill. It sounds like there's capacity with this DOE program here with the university. Is there capacity with DNR and DCCED for their portions of the program?
Through the chair, actually, I'd ask my staffer here, Katie, to speak to the fiscal note, answer that question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Mears, there are two fiscal notes. One is from the Department of Natural Resources, and there's also a fiscal note from DCCED, and we do have people available to answer specific questions on those.
Thank you. I just missed them.
Okay. Representative Dibert.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Sheets, for your presentation. I had the opportunity to attend the Alaska Corps CM stakeholder event in UAF with Representative Sadler, and I learned a whole lot, and I still can't say some of the critical minerals, but this is very exciting that Alaska's heading in this direction on critical minerals, and if we could find them throughout our state, that would be great, and this is a good start. My question was, going back, you mentioned Ray River, and there might be some critical minerals out there, and I've been on the Ray River, floated up it many times. It's a beautiful river just off of the bridge. And my question is, the communities of Rampart and Stevens Village, if we would reach out to these communities to get workforce and to have a bridge between them, if we move forward into projects like this where you're near communities where they might have youth that could get training and have jobs possibly in the future. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Sheets? We have two more presenters, so we can move on. Okay. All right. Director Sheets, if you would maybe stay on the line in case there's more questions as we go on, I'd appreciate it.
Well, indeed, and thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much for what you're doing on this topic. Next is Karen Mathias, the Executive Director of Alaska Metal Mines. Ms. Mathias, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. So please state your name and your affiliation for the record and begin your comments, please, Ms. Mathias.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Karen Mathias, and I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Metal Mines, formerly the Council of Alaska Producers. I appreciate this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 177. As you've heard, there's increasing demand for responsibly produced minerals and metals for components in renewable energy technologies, military equipment, consumer electronics, and other sectors of the economy, from transportation to healthcare. Our country's current dependence on mineral imports, often from adversarial countries, is a risk to our energy transition, our national security, and our economy. Clearly, the U.S. needs more domestic mineral production. Alaska, with its abundance of minerals and rigorous regulatory process, should be part of the solution. Since Representative Sadler and Mr. Sheets gave a great overview of critical minerals, I'll use my time to focus on a few key points from the perspective of Alaska's metal mines. First, there is a bit of a risk in focusing exclusively on the term critical minerals, simply because there are at least three different federal lists. The USGS, Department of Defense, Department of Energy all have different lists, and they change from year to year. So, for example, zinc was only just recently added to the USGS list. Another example to make this clear is copper. So it's not on the USGS list, but it is on the Department of Energy list. And the reason is because the USGS focuses on supply and demand today, whereas the Department of Energy looks out all the way to 2035 in their medium-term model. And they look at minerals both from how important they are to energy and also at the supply risk. And of course, there's widespread agreement that the amount of copper needed for clean energy technologies over the next decade greatly surpasses the expected supply. So while these lists help draw attention to the need to increase domestic mineral production, we think Alaska's focus really should be on the production of Alaska minerals. You know, we have one of the largest zinc mines in the world, which Mr. Sheets mentioned, and tremendous copper resources here in Alaska. But we also produce gold and silver and have rich deposits of many other minerals. So that brings me to my next point, which is we only have a small number of mines, and we have particular challenges due to energy costs and lack of infrastructure that make it difficult to turn our deposits into producing mines. You know, I think we all know the concept of industry clusters like Silicon Valley and the Biomed Research Triangle in North Carolina. They bring together companies, suppliers, R&D, workforce development that all support one another. And the fact is, Alaska needs a diverse mining industry in order to create that mutual support. Alaska's gold mines are key to the health of the industry here because access to a large pool of skilled workers, university research and vocational programs, and the businesses that supply goods and services, that all makes it easier for new companies to invest in exploration and development. Also, many of the listed critical minerals are not economically feasible to develop on their own. They're often produced as byproducts. And Mr. Sheets mentioned germanium, which is produced at Red Dog in northwestern Alaska. And as he said, it's one of the top producers of zinc in the world. It's simply not feasible to have a germanium mine there, but it's produced in Alaska thanks to a zinc mine. So it's important to be aware that sometimes an important critical mineral may only be possible by developing a mineral that may not be on, you know, any particular list at the moment. In closing, HB 177 calls for the state to investigate strategies to encourage investment and increase exploration and production of critical and essential minerals, and we think this is a worthy effort. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Mathias. Is there any questions for Ms. Mathias? All right, seeing none, finally we have Deantha Skibinski. Deantha, can you hear me?
I can hear you, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes. Deantha is the executive director of the Alaska Miners Association. And as part of our continuous redundant process, I will ask you to state your name and affiliation again for the record and begin your comments. Deantha, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Deantha Skibinski, and I'm the executive director of the Alaska Miners Association. AMA is a membership association that represents all aspects of Alaska's mining industry, from large hard rock and coal mines, mining exploration and development projects, small family placer mines, industrial gravel and rock, and the vendors and contractors that support the mines across the state. AME wishes to express support for the intent of the bill and offer suggestions for improvements. First, we wish to express our gratitude that the bill sponsor and this committee have prioritized these conversations that highlight the critical and essential minerals on which our society is dependent. Unfortunately, as Ms. Mathias mentioned, the majority of these minerals are currently sourced from foreign nations with adversarial relationships and unacceptable environmental and social values that we would not accept here in the United States and here in Alaska. The bill directs Alaska's government to assess the potential of sourcing many of these minerals here in our state and identify strategies that attract the investment we need to do so. Passage of legislation like this with these directives would send a powerful message to said investors that the state of Alaska is a jurisdiction of choice in which to invest. We would suggest to improve this bill that you would remove references to the global energy transition as it describes an unrealistic pivot from fossil-fueled energy generation. While the pursuit of renewable energies and the underlying increased need for mining and the minerals that it produces is needed to meet global energy demands, it's abundantly clear that relying on only renewable energy is not a reality for Alaska or the world. Solar panels and wind turbines and the other products we're talking about today are important supplements to base energy needs, but even with the battery storage technology we have today, they can't power a community for days or weeks, and only diverse sources of energy, including the reliable and dispatchable fossil fuels, will bring affordable and dependable heat and power to Alaska's residents and businesses. So to that end, we suggest that the word expansion could be instead be used to communicate the goals in discussion. But however and overall, HB 177 outlines how Alaska's mining industry should play a role in helping provide the essential minerals that the world needs today to develop alternative energy technologies. We all know that mining is done better here in Alaska, where our regulatory requirements ensure worker safety and excellent environmental performance. Thank you for hearing this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer questions or provide additional information anytime. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Skibinski. Any questions for Ms. Skibinski at this moment? Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just have one question and then a comment. How's the weather in Big Lake today?
Representative McCabe, through the chair, the weather is cold, but not as cold as a lot of our colleagues across the lower 48, so it feels kind of good to gloat about that.
Thanks, and I appreciate the suggestion from through the chair. I appreciate the suggestion for the change from transition to expansion, and I can offer it as amendment to Rep. Sadler or somebody else could. I think it's a really good. We are kind of moving away from that energy transition thing. I think nationwide, essentially worldwide, with some of the new information that's coming up. So I appreciate it, Ms. Skibinski, and thanks for your testimony.
Representative Sadler.
To that point, through the chair, Representative McCabe, I appreciate that. I will be very amenable to that amendment. I've also heard the energy addition is the other way to put it. Because yes, we need basically an all-the-above strategy. Thank you.
Okay, so we also have on the line Melanie Worden of the Alaska Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys of the DNR. We have Sandra Mahler, the Director of the Division of Community and Regional Affairs, and Lorelei Simon of Usabelli Coal Mine. So are there any questions for those three ladies? Or would those three ladies like to make any brief comments? Silence means no. All right. Are they really there? I do, at the risk of going long, I do have one more question for Mr. Sheets. Brent, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay. We went through kind of quickly, and I'm just a regular guy. So your slide number 6 had some expenditures required. Cost share, total budget. I think Representative Mears touched on it, but are you looking for funds from the state to help with these numbers on slide 6 this year? Or is that coming from somewhere else? I'm just a little confused.
No problem. This slide is simply meant to point out what DOE is contributing. So if we are selected for phase two, and there is that down select, so there's always that unease, we will have to come up with $1.87 million in match in order to meet our 20% requirement. It's up to the university to decide what they want to make as a priority for a request. I'm happy to report, though, that state funds through agencies like DGGS or potentially community economic development, if DGGS is a partner with us already, so whatever funds DGGS spends in support of our program, I get to count those expenditures. So the staff time that they spend, the travel dollars that they spend, the analysis money that they spend, all that they spend, as long as they document it, I'm able to claim those expenditures as part of that $1.87 million that we need. So whoever else joins us in the state, perhaps economic development groups or whatever, those expenditures, as long as they're officially recognized by DOE as being a partner for us, their expenditures in furtherance of our objectives, I can count as in-kind match. So I'm not prepared to say that the university needs $1.87 million from the state directly to the university. However, of course, being the university, they never turn it down, but there are alternative paths, and the other alternatives seem to be working fine. So.
Okay, so I guess what I'm going to conclude then is when we do our budget subcommittee work on House resources for the DNR, we will look for this under the DGGS department budget, right? Okay, so everybody on the committee be looking for that, okay? All right, I think that's all I need.
And I believe you have Director Worden on the phone, so she may have a comment on that. I can't speak for the DGGS, so.
Okay, Representative Baker has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I'm not sure if this would be a more appropriate question for Mr. Sheets or for the sponsor of the bill. I'm just curious how landowners will be incorporated in these efforts at the levels of regional corporations, village corporations, tribes, and just making sure that local knowledge, traditional ecological knowledge is being put into this. The Red Dog Mine was brought up several times. I'm proud to say that my grandfather was the pilot who discovered the mine site. And as a former employer of Tech Alaska, I have a little bit of zinc in my blood. So it's really important to recognize the mine site being on Nana Regional Corporation land and having the impact to the shareholders, to the local people of the region. And I know other stakeholders are mentioned, but how will those local level landowners be incorporated with this whole process?
You let me know if I'm supposed to answer, otherwise I'll sit quiet.
Representative Sadler, never short for words. I will refer to you.
I will stay short. I'll relieve Director Sheets of that obligation. Through the chair, Representative Baker, thank you for the question. And I think the answer is very well. I think I know that I'm very proud of what DNR has done in soliciting input from local communities, getting that social license to acknowledging and implementing traditional values. I know that the Federal Department of Energy, which is where a lot of the money for CORE is going to come from, is very much focused under this administration on tribal relations and tribal inclusion in the processes. And I guess I would repeat the same question I gave to an earlier question. Alaska's mineral development goes, I think, above and beyond to make sure that they do incorporate local knowledge and obtain the approval and input of local communities. I'm very confident of that.
Okay. Are there any other questions for any of our guests today? All right, last chance. So I appreciate everyone presenting today. This is very exciting. Seeing that there are no further questions, I will set an amendment deadline for 12 o'clock Monday, January 22nd, and we will hold HB 177 in committee until then. In closing, I know Representative Armstrong expressed a strong interest in mining and minerals, so I hope we're off to a good start. And is there any other business before us today? If I'm not mistaken, we'll meet again on Friday, Committee A, Dan, is that correct? Friday at 1 o'clock. And so I'll adjourn our meeting, and I really thank everybody for coming back, and we're off to a good start. Thank you.